Hey there, friend. My name's Sarai, and I host a spooky, casual podcast called Freaky AF, where I tell you stories of conspiracies, true crime, and of the supernatural. So if that's your kind of shiz, come check us out. I'm sure we'll be great friends. You can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Spreaker, and a bunch of other places. Or you can look us up on Twitter and Instagram. We're Freaky AF Pod. That's FreakyAFPod. Come get spooked, y'all. Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. During the night, while you're fast asleep in your home, feeling safe and secure, you never know who could be lurking outside, praying and plotting, which is a terrifying thought. Today's episode is a chilling case that involves a petrifying break-in during the dark, early hours of the morning, and a hex that was put on people that seemed to be successful. Or was it mere coincidence? Let's get started. Charles and Dealey Bird adopted a little boy who was born on December 14, 1901. They named him Jake Bird. The little family lived somewhere with, quote, one post office in the countryside of Louisiana. Jake Bird moved out of his home at 19 years old and could never stay in one place for long periods of time. Jake was a drifter who was always on the lookout for new job opportunities. He grew up in poverty and had a rough childhood. However, it seemed that now he wanted to better his situation. He would usually work as one of the section gang laborers, also known as Gandy Dancers, with railroads. It was called Gandy Dancing due to the workers waddling like ganders when they ran on the railroad ties in a movement that looked like silly dancing. Also, the lining bar of the train track started to be known as a Gandy Lever to keep the railroad tracks aligned. Jake's job was to maintain certain sections of the railway. One person would hold a bar, and a few others would use rail tongs to get the rail in the correct spot. In the U.S., section gang workers were usually immigrants and ethnic minorities who needed to work no matter how terrible the pay was, and even if the working conditions were awful. Jake was definitely putting in tough physical labor, and with this job, he was able to travel around really easily in the trains. The travels from town to town would eventually come to a halt on October 30th, 1947. Jake was prowling down a street in Tacoma, Washington, up to no good. He went around to the backside of someone's home and discovered an axe in their shed. Jake began to strip down naked as a jaybird. He grabbed the axe and proceeded to make his way into the home. Inside was Bertha Klutt, a Russian-born woman who was 52 years old, and her daughter, 17-year-old Beverly. Jake was running stark naked through their house, wielding the axe. He went into Bertha's bedroom and stole $1.50 out of her purse. Bertha's bedroom was across from the kitchen, and when Jake got into the kitchen, Bertha was behind him. He took the axe and began to beat her with it, eventually using it to chop her. Beverly heard the shrieks and cries of her mother and came barreling down the stairs to see this disturbing scene. Fear and adrenaline struck as she ran towards the stranger in her home, clutching him from behind, doing her best to get him off of her mother. As hard as she fought this man, he overpowered her and heartbreakingly mutilated both the mother and daughter. It was a little past 2 a.m. when the neighbors heard the blood-curdling screams that would put chills down anyone's spine, and immediately they rang the police station. The officers got on the scene a little too late. When the police got to Bertha's residence at 2:30 in the morning on October 30th, Jake had already taken Bertha and Beverly's lives by hitting them with the blunt side of the axe, as well as hacking away at the helpless victims. The police began to do a walkthrough of the home, and they saw a man take off through the back door, darting through the backyard and hopping over a picket fence. The police began to chase him. Suddenly, after leaping over too many fences, there was nowhere left to run. They were all put to a stop by a fence, too high to jump over, in an alley. Knowing he was cornered and caught, Jake charged towards the two police officers that had been chasing him with a knife. First, Jake cut one of the officer's hands, and he stabbed the other in the shoulder. But eventually, things got even more intense in the police car when one of the officers, who happened to be a prize fighter, beat the absolute hell out of Jake with a mean left hook to the jaw. But he didn't stop there. He kicked him in the testicles, and more details came out about this attack in trial. To no surprise, Jake fainted after the severe beating, and what I imagine the main cause of the fainting would be was the severe pain when he was struck in his testicles. For the next few days to come, Jake's temporary place to stay was the Tacoma General Hospital. There, he was treated for the cuts on his head and face. The officers also had to be taken to the hospital due to one of them having a major back injury and the other having to get his hand stitched up and wrapped. The police went back to the home of Bertha and Beverly's, finding that the mother, Bertha, was deceased in her bedroom, which was across from the kitchen where her daughter Beverly had been killed. The axe remained at the scene. The detective on the case concluded that Jake did try to sexually assault Bertha before he took her life. Years before her tragic murder, Bertha had come to America from Russia with her husband Edward Klutt. They had a son named Arthur who was born in Canada. The Klutts gained their American citizenship and settled in Tacoma, Washington, where Edward was a carpenter. 6.5 years before the brutal murders, Edward passed away. Bertha and Edward had 5 children together, but the youngest was Beverly, who was the only child who still lived with her mother. Their other children were Arthur, Alma, Doris, and Myrtle. On the 31st of October, Jake was charged with first-degree murder, but only for Bertha's death. It was normal to file only one charge in a case with several murders, where failure to gain a guilty verdict on the first murder would warrant the filing of extra murder charges. When police talked to Jake about the charges that he faced, he denied everything, and he pleaded not guilty at his arraignment. However, he had given a signed confession already, which comes back up during the trial. Jake's defense attorney asked for the venue to be changed due to the possibility that his client would not get a fair trial in Pierce County. This attorney also made a request stating that he did not want to represent Jake Byrd and wanted to be let go because Jake wanted to represent himself. The change of venue request was denied. The request for the attorney stepping down to let Jake represent himself was also denied. A trial was held over the course of 1.5 days. The prosecution wanted to prove to the court that the murder of Bertha Klutt was premeditated, so Jake would be eligible for the death penalty. There was a lot of evidence presented at trial. The cops had found blood and brain matter in Jake's pants from both Bertha and Beverly Klutt, and it also covered his clothes. His bloody fingerprints were all in the house, on the axe used, and his shoes were left behind at the scene of the slaughter. The state brought a police officer to the stand as a surprise witness who testified that he and another officer attacked Jake while he was in custody. Quote, "I regret to say that I lost my temper after returning from the Klutt home and viewing the terribly hacked bodies of the two women. I had asked Byrd as we sat in the patrol wagon why he murdered the two women. He said he didn't do it. I asked him who did it then, and he said it was Leroy. Who's Leroy? I asked him. Oh, another N-word around town, Bird replied. You're lying, I said, and he looked at me with a smug and insolent look. I know I shouldn't have done it, but I hit him in the jaw with my fist, knocking him to the front of the patrol wagon. Then I struck him a number of times with my nightstick until he said, "Don't kill me." That brought me to my senses, and we took him to the hospital where a nurse said he wasn't badly hurt. End quote. As I mentioned earlier, Jake had confessed, saying he was expecting what he called an easy robbery that went wrong. He also said he brought the axe from the shed, quote, to bluff off anyone who tried to bother me. Jake claims that he tried to tell Bertha he just wanted her money and to get his shoes, then he would leave. However, things got heated and he took their lives. He also had an excuse for stabbing the police officers. Jake said he believed the cops were going to shoot him once he was cornered in the alley, and that's why he took out his knife and began to attack. When the prosecutor went to put his signed confession into evidence, Jake's defense attorney objected immediately. He stated that his client had said those things under duress, and it was inadmissible. The judge did not agree with the defense at all and said there was no connection when it came to the policeman beating Jake and his voluntary confessions, so Jake's confession was allowed into evidence. After the prosecutor read Jake's confession, the prosecution rested. Jake's defense attorney rested the defense and did not bother calling his client or any witnesses to testify. Obviously, that could have only made matters worse, and Jake clearly committed these two murders. The jury in the Pierce County Court found Jake guilty of first-degree murder in just 35 minutes of deliberating, and Jake was sentenced to die. He seemed to not care at all when the verdict was announced, and even said on the way to the jail to five deputies who were guarding him, quote, "What's all the excitement about?" However, even though he seemed emotionless, he must have cared a little, because he did attempt to appeal a few times. Jake's death would be prolonged for 2 years, and it was during these 2 years that Jake admitted he had gotten away with much more in the past. According to the Tacoma News Tribune, on Saturday, December 6, 1947, the judge sentenced Jake to be hanged on the gallows at the Washington State Penitentiary on January 16, 1948. After a motion for a new trial was denied by the judge, Jake's defense attorney told the court he had done everything he could to defend Jake Bird and that no further appeals would be made on Jake's behalf. He also said, quote, "I feel whenever any man, 45 years old, gets an idea that no lives are safe to anyone except his own, that man is a detriment to society and should be obliterated." End quote. The judge asked Jake if he had any comment about that, and he stated, quote, "I was given no chance to defend myself. My own lawyers just asked you to hang me. They apologized for defending me. If they were so reluctant to defend me, why did they contest the prosecutor's proof of murder? And now they say that everything is proven." End quote. Jake went on for about 20 minutes and lastly said, quote, "I'm putting the hex of Jake Bird on all of you who had anything to do with my being punished. Mark my words, you will die before I do. Wait and see. You policemen and judges will be sitting and waiting at the pearly gates a long time before I roll up." End quote. This statement would forever be known as the Jake Bird Hex. At the time it was said, nobody really paid it any mind. That is, until people actually started dying. The mystery that surrounds these deaths makes some people wonder if Jake really possessed the power to curse people. Within a year's time, six men associated with Jake Bird's trial would perish. The six men connected with Byrd's trial, who died within a year of the Jake Byrd hex, were Edward D. Hodge, Pierce County Superior Court Judge, age 69, died on January 1, 1948. Joseph E. Carpatch, Pierce County Undersheriff, age 46, died on April 5, 1948. George L. Harrigan, Pierce County Court Reporter, age 69, died June 11, 1948. Sherman W. Lyons, Tacoma Police Detective Lieutenant, age 46, died on October 28, 1948. James W. Selden, Byrd's defense attorney, age 76, died on November 26, 1948. According to the Tacoma News Tribune, all of the men died from a heart attack. 2 months before Jake's death, a sixth man who was a Washington State Penitentiary guard assigned to death row died of pneumonia. Were these men's deaths all a coincidence, or was it something more malevolent? How did Jake react to these deaths? He laughed and said, quote, "Nothing to it, never felt better in my life," end quote. It is rumored that he also put a hex on a few of his fellow prison inmates, and supposedly six of them died. However, that's just gossip that can't be proven, and could be like a game of telephone. The next day after he brewed the hex, on December 7, 1947, Jake Byrd was being taken to the Washington State Pen in Walla Walla, where he would spend his time waiting to be hanged. It was after getting to the penitentiary that Jake began to reveal all of the crimes he committed over the last 20 years that no one knew about. The governor, prosecutor, and Tacoma police detective were contacted to go to the penitentiary to hear what Jake had to say. And finally, on January 6, 1948, a month later, they listened to Jake as he needed to, quote, clear his conscience. The prosecutor made sure to tell the public, quote, "We want to give him a chance to tell it, but we don't intend to permit him to use what he might have withheld as a means to add a few days to his life," end quote. These confession notes that the prosecutor and detective took ended up being 174 pages to send to the governor. While Jake had been working on the railroad and taking the train state to state, he was taking lives all along his travels. It's suspected that he murdered upwards of 44 people. Some believe the police blamed a lot of unsolved murders on Jake Byrd because it was easy, but reportedly Jake Byrd did know enough about the murders to be a prime suspect. 11 murders beyond a reasonable doubt were committed by Jake in Louisville, Kentucky, Omaha, Nebraska, Kansas City, Kansas, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Cleveland, Ohio, Orlando, Florida, and Portage, Wisconsin. In the murders that were confirmed to have been committed by Jake, most of his victims were white females, and most of them had their lives taken away from them with hatchets or axes while in their homes. While awaiting his death, psychiatrists studied Jake Byrd and said he was a psychopath, that he developed a sick satisfaction when he saw women shrinking down and recoiling in fear. Jake was supposed to be hanged on January 14, 1949, but his new attorney requested a move for a stay of execution to allow him to appeal. The motion was allowed, but only if the court would agree to look over the case, which the U.S. Court of Appeals refused to do. The judge set the new execution date for July 15, 1949. Again, Jake's defense attorney filed a motion for stay of execution so Jake could file another appeal, but the motion was rejected, and the execution date stayed the same. The night before his death, Thursday, July 14, 1949, Jake had his last meal while talking to his attorney for a few hours. He said to his attorney that he could be a good loser about the whole thing if he believed that everything possible had been done in an attempt to save his life. Later that night, he was taken to a cell near the gallows. There, Jake had his head shaven and was given new clothes. The clock struck midnight on July 15, 1949, and Jake's time was up. He was walked from his cell to the gallows. 125 witnesses were there, but Jake said nothing at first. While he had the noose around his neck, above the trap door, a volunteer prison chaplain began to read a note that Jake had written that said he didn't have any spite towards anyone, and he hoped that he could be forgiven for all the wrong that he had done. Before the chaplain could even finish the note, the trap door flew open and Jake Bird plummeted 5 feet below to his demise at 12:20 a.m. He hung and swayed for about 14 minutes, then was removed from the rope and a physician pronounced him deceased. Jake was buried in an unmarked grave in the prison graveyard, only to be recognized as convict number 21520. Jake had left his riches of $6.15 to his appeals attorney. He may not have been formally educated, but he did achieve a smidgen of notoriety as a, quote, jailhouse lawyer. Since, as we know, Jake many times argued his own case in front of the court, he did have a good bit of knowledge about the law. Plus, he had people against the death penalty on his side, and successfully prolonged his execution. That's how he gained the nickname and infamy. Even though Jake could have murdered upwards of 44 people across the U.S., his case did not get noticed much in the national press at all. However, he is recognized in history of murderers to be one of America's most prolific serial killers. Unfortunately, there is no information or even names that I could find of the other victims of Jake Bird. This concludes today's episode. As always, thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay safe and take care.